Thanks for joining us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. You know what? It's time to take a look at your pet's health. And who? None other than Dr. Bill Stork with us back once again. It's always a pleasure to have him stop by. He's the owner and operator of the Lake Mills Veterinary Clinic. And you can join in with your own questions or comments about your pet's health. What's going on? We're going to be talking about winter cold a bit and dealing with that and some other things as well. But the number, 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Dr. Bill Stork, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Well, good morning, Larry. Good to be here. Thanks for having us.
You know what? I'm betting that winter's on the way, and I'm betting it's going to get cold. And I'm betting that there'll be even some really cold times. And when we think about dogs and the nice walks we, you know, you love to take with your dog, when is it too cold to take a dog outside?
You know, Larry, that's a conversation that comes up fairly frequently at the Lake Mills Veterinary Clinic and probably everyone else as well. And as is the case with many situations, it's well worth holding up our preconceived notions, holding up our assumptions, and re-examining them on a fairly daily basis. Because, you know, we'll have folks come in with a 10-month-old Labrador Retriever, and they'll say things to the effect of, man, it's just too cold. He just does not want to go for a walk. And in my mind, I'm thinking, well, have you seen a map? And you go way up above Maine, just across from Nova Scotia, and there's Labrador and where that dog came from. And there's a dog that, if you ask him, will jump in a nearly frozen lake. And sometimes it's truly is the dog. You know, if you've got yourself a Chihuahua or a Yorkie or a naked breed to that effect, maybe they don't want to go out in the cold. But more frequently, just as you bet, here comes the cold and here comes the dark, all of which can be impediments to getting our dogs out and staying active. But now, while it's temperate, reasonable and light, my suggestion would be to plan ahead. And the Norwegians have a famous saying, there is no such thing as bad weather, just a poor choice of clothes. And that holds up both with us and for our pets. And we know we know what happens in Wisconsin in December and January. So plan for it. For us, of course, you know, that involves an insulative layer and a windbreaking layer, something on our hands, face, and feet. And man, the industry has responded to what people are willing to spend for their pets. And there are all kinds of options out there. You know, if you have a Labrador Retriever, a Golden Retriever, those dogs are going to be just fine until it gets really, really cold. A real consideration, no matter what the breed is their feet. And their feet have a tendency to be one of the limiting factors when it gets really, really cold, when sidewalks either get icy or there is salt on the sidewalks. And dogs don't care to have things on their feet unless you get them acclimated to it. And the time to get them acclimated to it is not on that day when it is snowed and the sidewalks have been salted, or when it's 8 degrees below zero and the concrete is painfully cold on their paws. The time to get them used to having things on their feet, and there are some amazing configuration of booties and stuff like that that can help them out a great deal. Another really big deal is visibility, and there's all kinds of options for us. They make every conceivable configuration of headlamps and chest lights and things like that, so we can, one, see if there's ice on the sidewalk where we're walking the dog, and two, be seen in the event that we're walking our dogs in the vicinity of traffic. And then for our dogs, my dog Tugger is like the camo dog. And unless there's snow on the ground, he disappears no matter where he is. So we have an LED light up collar for him so that we can see him when we live in the country. He doesn't know much about leashes or restraint, but we can always know where he is by virtue of having those lights. So, you know, give it some thought. Know what's coming. We live in Wisconsin. There's going to be four months of perpetual darkness and potentially cold. And so my solution is to gear up and go. And if you can't, then we have to lean into indoor recreation options. Yeah.
Do you have some tips on that? I mean, what do you do to get your dog some exercise while he or she is in the house?
One of the most charming memories that I have, we had a dear friend, a dear client here at the clinic, belonged to an elderly gentleman, and he had a dog named Ringo. And he and Ringo used to play hide and seek in the house. And he taught the dog to sit and stay. And then he would find a closet or a cabinet or a room, and he would run around the house, and they would play hide and seek for a significant period of every day. Young athletic dogs. There is a place in Madison out on the west side called Canine Sports Zones, and they have every conceivable activity and the space to do it. Out here in the country, we've got Farm and Fleet, and I don't need many excuses to go to Farm and Fleet. No. And to take my dog there for a walk is an even better excuse, and they're more than happy to have them. Tractor Supply, a store called Tyson's. I don't know what goes on at malls anymore. I don't think they sell a lot of stuff. And once upon a time, I thought there were designated times when you could take your dog and walk them around the malls. But there are snuffle mats and puzzle bowls and frozen Kongs and things that you can do to burn off some of your dog's mental and physical energy inside.
I think they can get cabin fever just like we can.
Without the slightest shadow of a doubt, and a very popular response, a thing that we'll hear here at the clinic is, oh, it's okay, we've got a fenced-in backyard. And a fenced-in backyard is absolutely wonderful piece of safety. You know, you get up at 4:30 in the morning and it's 12 degrees below zero outside. You can let the dog out. They can do their business and come back in. But please, please, please don't count on that as your only form of entertainment and fulfillment. Because as you say, yes, they can absolutely get cabin fever. I mean, even a dog can only sleep about 18 hours a day. And every form of stimulation can do them well.
Let's take some calls. Nick in Green Bay has a question for you. Let's go there. Hi, Nick.
I got a quick question, but I want to tell you a quick story real quick. Like a month ago, we just got a black cat because our old cat died, and I've got a 109-pound black lab, Max. Oh, my God. That cat pushes him around, and the cat's only 10 pounds. So my question for you is, Max is 9 years old. He's an English black lab. I didn't know there was a difference. And I noticed lately, when he gets off the couch, he's limping a little bit. And it's not all the time. It's like just randomly. And it's not, it's like maybe once a month if he's lucky. And it's his like front paw. And I was wondering if that could just be arthritis since he is 9 years old now.
Well, first of all, Nick in Green Bay, there is that old saying about fighting like cats and dogs. And honestly, I find that cats and dogs get along better than cats and cats do. And second of all, with regard to the English lab, you can tell that they'll have a little bit of an accent in their bark. You can tell English versus the domestic breeds. But right on clue with regard to a 9-year-old 105-pound lab, yeah, there's a whole lot of things you can do from here. And first and foremost, and it appeals to logic, I haven't met your dog, but motion is medicine. We want as much exercise as they can comfortably get. And if perchance any of those 105 pounds are extra, then weight loss can make a dramatic difference for these guys. To which you say, well, that's great, wise guy, but how am I going to take weight off the dog if his leg hurts sometimes? And yeah, there's a really good chance that at 9 years of age, he's starting to get a little bit of arthritis in could be his elbow, could be his shoulder. And the notion that it's relatively infrequent, that's good. It's also time when we start to fold in some of the joint supportive supplements, things like glucosamine, MSM, turmeric is a good one. Fish oil is another. And some of the things to realize with regard to these supplements are they're only valuable if given, one, from a reliable source at a meaningful dose consistently. Glucosamine isn't going to be of any value in a situational fashion. But then what we usually do with our patients and clients when they have situational or occasional limping or lameness is we get them fixed up with an anti-inflammatory so we can take the edge off of that discomfort that he's having.
Nick, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Andy in La Crosse, we'll go to you. Hi, Andy.
Hey, how y'all doing?
Good. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
Yeah, great. So I have a male cat who recently had some urinary tract problems, crystals in the urine. And so the result was a very expensive prescription medication, food. And so what I'm asking is there any over-the-counter type diets that you could recommend for a cat, you know, prone to these sort of issues?
So first of all, Andy, lovely up by you. I was just through La Crosse yesterday on our way to Houston, Minnesota. But unfortunately, the answer to the question is no. There is not a reasonable, reliable, over-the-counter substitute. You're probably either on urinary SO or Hill's CD. And I feel your pain because I have a couple of cats who also must be on that food. And for my cats, literally, if I try and sneak in over-the-counter food for a week, they will be peeing blood. And yes, the food is crazy expensive, but man, you should see the vet bill for an obstructed cat, a cat with a urinary obstruction, not to mention the fact that it can be life-threatening and it's really, really painful for them as well. So as much as I'd tell you in a heartbeat if there was a reliable over-the-counter option, but that's one of those things that just seems to work.
Yeah, boy, I can really second that motion because I had the same issue with my cat, and he's on urinary SO, and I tried to take him off that for about a week because I thought, well, let me try something else. And it wasn't, immediately he was spotting blood all over the house.
Yeah, it's like $136 for a 17-pound bag or something like that, which is real money, but it's the consequences of not are significant.
Yeah. Andy, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Dr. Bill Stork, our guest today, owner and operator of the Lake Mills Veterinary Clinic. Oh, he's also an author. He's got a really fun book out. You can join in at 800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today as we talk your pet's health with Dr. Bill Stork of the Lake Mills Veterinary Clinic. Great to have him with us. At 12:30, just to remind you, we revisit a conversation we had with Appleton veterinarian Dr. Laura Russo-Clister about caring for rabbits, hamsters, and guinea pigs. That's at 12:30. Right now, taking your questions, and let's move to Mark in Wisconsin Dells next. Mark, thank you for calling.
Yeah, Larry, last time I was on, I was about to tell you how to get rid of pet urine odors in carpet and fabrics and furniture and so forth, and we ran out of time. So I'll just finish here real quick. So I was buying the product. I couldn't buy it anymore because the people who sold it had died, and I was left with the problem of trying to figure out what it was that was active in that product. And I discovered that it was ammonia, just simply ammonia. It's very reactive, and it changes the chemistry of what's causing the odor, and that's why the odor goes away. So as an example, one day I was driving through Baraboo, and somebody had thrown out a large oval carpet or rug, and I wanted to put it under my car in the garage. So I took it home and stomached the odor all the way home, 27 miles. When I got home, I laid it upon a picnic table, and I got two bottles of ammonia. I think they were half-gallon bottles, and I soaked that whole carpet up. And when it dried, that was it. It was just like a brand-new carpet with no odor whatsoever.
Hmm. Well, that flies against logic for me, Dr. Bill, but what do you think?
I think it worked for Mark. And I would think that, you know, for a rug in the garage, it works well. Ammonia, we also know to have a pretty powerful odor itself, which would be a little bit of a concern on the inside of the house. But it is not my nature to fly in the face of something that worked. So,
okay, Mark, thank you for calling back. Appreciate your call. Sarah in Santa Monica, California. Your turn. Hi, Sarah.
Hey, Larry. I got a question about kidney disease in dogs. My 16-year-old Schnoodle has had Cushing's disease for over 3 years now, and all of her numbers are fine with the ACTH stim test, but her kidney levels were a little weird last time we went in, so we're thinking that maybe, you know, it's the beginnings of the kidney disease for her. But kind of just wondering, like, what the prognosis is for a dog of her age with her health issue and what that would mean if she does have kidney disease and what kind of tests they would do or medications they would suggest and kind of what our life might be looking like if she does end up having this.
And how old was she again, Sarah?
She's 16.
16, okay.
Well, Sarah, I don't have a great deal. I don't have necessarily details with regard to kidney values being a little bit out of whack. And if they are indeed just a little bit elevated in a 16-year-old dog that's been wrestling with Cushing's disease for 3 years, my response is, awesome on your part for managing the Cushing's disease as well as your veterinarian. It sounds like you're getting some great care out there. And with regard to elevated kidney values in a 16-year-old dog under those circumstances, in a broad sense, which is all I can speak to under these circumstances, is, you know, we keep them eating, we keep them hydrated, and I bet those kidneys aren't going to be the limiting issue on her lifespan.
So just nothing special. Well, the specialty is keep them eating and keeping them.
And absolutely keep them hydrated. And here again, I can't exactly speak to that because I don't know what those values look like. And there are a handful of values, blood values that we look at, BUN, creatinine, phosphorus, SDMA, in cats and dogs. And if they're modest, to be honest with you, I'll turn this around on you. If they're modestly elevated in a 16-year-old cat, that's a really good day. Or a 16-year-old dog, that's a really good day.
A really good day. Sarah, there you go. Thanks so much for calling. I appreciate your call. Let's turn to Jim in Kenosha next. Jim, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Before I tell you about our Princess Leah cat, just 20 seconds about the ammonia. You got to watch out for asphyxiation. And if you've already mixed bleach with the ammonia, the ammonia will actually release the chlorine gas and asphyxiate you. So, and it can also discolor the carpet if you're trying to work on carpet that you're going to keep inside. So anyways, with Princess Leah, it was this young cat that's very hyper, and the first year that it was adopted, no trouble at all. It was kind of a hyper cat, and they actually had to put it on some medication, but it suddenly started urinating everywhere. But what's curious about it is the cat, nothing really changed. It wasn't the medication. It was before the medication, and what had happened was it just suddenly started just urinating everywhere. And, you know, that people that don't have cats don't realize how serious that is. It's just, it's really serious. What do you think happened? And what can you do to work on a problem cat that has that issue?
Is there another cat in the house?
No.
Okay.
Yeah. So Jim, the first thing that I will say is to echo the severity of the situation. It's a really big deal. And some of the things that we start off addressing in situations like this, first of all, we ask folks to dispense of the notion that nothing has changed. And nothing has to change in order for them to start urinating outside the litter box. And two, nothing may have changed in our world, but when it comes to cats and dogs, their sense of smell and their senses of perceptions are so much more acute than ours. They see, hear, smell, and feel things that we don't necessarily. Is there any rhyme or reason to where in the house they're going? For example, is it anywhere near the litter boxes? Is it anywhere near doors or windows or the periphery of the house?
Can you hear me?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I'm still on. Okay. Yeah, so that's a good question because it's nowhere near the litter boxes. It's where all the people are. It's peeing on the beds, peeing on the couches, peeing on the love seat. Yeah, mm-hmm. Not on the floor. Where all the humans are.
Okay. All right. And then what's your configuration? Are you all on one floor, two stores, three floors of the house? And how many litter boxes do you have?
Okay, there's a plethora of litter boxes. I don't live there. This is my 93-year-old mother, and my sister is a caregiver there, and it's basically her cat. But she spoils her. She gets lots of love, lots of attention. There's several litter boxes. There's lots of toys. There's lots of perches.
Mm. Man, that's tough. And good. I'm glad that there's lots of litter boxes, but there are and there are things that matter. Like, are those litter boxes scooped out every single solitary day? Are there any offensive odors in those litter boxes? We were talking about ammonia and things like that. Those litter boxes, it's best if they are cleaned out every day. It's best if they are in multiple locations throughout your house. It's best if we use unscented litter. If any of those are robotic litter boxes, I bet they're not. Sometimes robotic litter boxes work out great. Sometimes they don't. You just have to work on all of those potential variables. Sounds like the cat gets lots of stimulation. The only other card that may not have been played is pheromone therapy, things like feel away, which to old guys like me sounds like hocus pocus medicine, but I have seen situations where feel away, which is a plug-in pheromone product, has helped in these situations. And you got a tough situation, Jim.
Yeah, it probably wouldn't hurt if they haven't had the cat to the vet. Could that be an indication of maybe something wrong with the...
From the top, absolutely. And I left that out, which is we have to approach this from every conceivable behavioral, medical, which as Larry says, urinalysis, blood work, to make sure that we're healthy and there's not a medical underpinning. And environmental considerations as well.
You mentioned you were asking where, and you mentioned asked if the cat was peeing near the litter box. The answer was no. But what if you have a situation like that where the cat is going right next to the litter box?
That we suppose that, we hope that. In situations like that, there's just something about that litter that the cat doesn't care for, whether it be the consistency, whether it be the odor. There's actually litter that's made that has lavender scent to it. Lavender is the scent that you use if you want to repel cats, and they make litter that is lavender scented. Situations like this will sometimes find that the cats are urinating near the perimeter of the house, and that can be suggestive that there's a neighborhood cat that's hanging around in the yard or around the house.
Jim, thank you very much for calling. We'll turn now to Sherry in Fall Creek. Sherry, thank you for joining in.
Hi, thank you for having me. We have a 4-pound, 8-year-old teacup poodle, and I'm wondering if dog food with salmon in it is something that would be good for him.
Sure, yeah, and so long as it's a good brand, like Fromm's, for example, is a great brand of food. But yeah, do you have any specific medical worries with regard to your little bitty?
No, I bought some very expensive dog food. I mean, it was really expensive, and he wouldn't touch it. He sorted all through, only ate one kibble out of all of it. And I went back to the salmon dog food, and he eats it all.
he likes the salmon.
Yeah.
Well, evidently, the little guy has spoken, and thankfully, he's not a Great Dane. Otherwise, it would be a heck of a lot more of that expensive food.
Sherry, no problems. Thank you for calling. Appreciate it very much. Vivian in Green Bay, your turn. Hi, Vivian.
Hi. I'd like to offer some encouragement. A few years ago, I took in my late sister's cat. And my sister was 88, and during the final years, the cat lost all her litter box training, and the house really smelled. So I took the cat into a home with two other cats, and I retrained her, confining her to a small space, a litter box, much as you might do to piddle-pad train a dog. And eventually, the treats, immediate treats, after she used the litter box, now she's 18, and she uses the litter box faithfully.
Yeah.
Well, that is both kind, compassionate, brave, and diligent of you, Vivian. So nicely done and great suggestions.
And I like the immediately. When you're doing a treat thing, it needs to be kind of immediate.
So that they make the association. Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. Virginia in Green Bay, your turn. Hi, Virginia.
Hi. I'm calling because I lost my 20-year-old cat. She gave up into cancer. She was a sweetie, and after a year and a half, I feel like I could get another cat, probably an adult cat. But I would like a cat that is fronty clawed, even if I have to do it myself. And my argument against all of the vets who say, oh, now we're certified, we can't do this, is would you rather have the cat be put down in that situation because they can't find an owner, or would you rather have the cat fronty clawed by me?
So with regard to the declaw, Virginia, what is your concern with regard to the cat and the claws?
Ripping up the house.
Okay. And to which our response is multifold, and your argument is rock solid. Would you rather have the cat put to sleep, or would you rather have the cat declawed? From our side, you know, we talk about declawing, and not everyone realizes, I'm sure you do, that it's not taking the claws off. It's taking 10 digits off. It's amputating the most distal digit for those guys. And in a lot of cases, there can be some residual significant discomfort, especially in an aged or an adult cat. And other alternatives, and I'm sure that your people have spoken with you about this as well, is most cats are really fine about having their nails trimmed. And trimming the nails on a cat is a pretty easy thing to do and goes fairly quickly. And then their nails are pretty blunt. Larry's a cat guy, so you're also probably familiar with nail caps. They make glue-on nail caps. Man, that works for some people. I would rather just trim their nails, to be honest with you. And then somewhere along the line, another caller talked about engagement, having cat trees and having balls and playing fetch and chasing feathers on a string and things like that. All of those things can go a long way with regard to placating their need to use their claws. And in my experience, it seems like most cats, once they settle into an environment, it's a pretty minimal risk.
Virginia, thanks for calling. I've got a related one here, an email from Peter. Nail trimming can be tricky. He normally uses a Dremel with a sanding disc, but they had a mishap once and used a nail clipper in lieu of the Dremel and hit the quick. And he was wondering the best product to stop the bleeding in that kind of a situation. He used quick clot powder. Are there any other recommendations?
Yeah, quick clot powder is not easy to say, but it's easy to use, and it's pretty effective for things like that. You know, cornstarch can help. And yeah, we hope not to do that. It can be momentarily uncomfortable for the cat if we clip their quick. But the thing about cats' nails are they're pretty distinctly curved, and the enormous majority of the time, they're pretty transparent. So you can see exactly where the quick is. And if a Dremel works for him, that's beautiful. Both you and the cat have to be a little bit patient because it takes a while to remove much material for a Dremel. And honestly, my favorite tool for trimming a cat's nails is a toenail trimmer for people, because you can go parallel to the nail and make a nice clean cut, and they usually do just fine.
And they're bigger.
And
they're just easier to hold and easier to work with. Absolutely right. You can join in too, by the way. Questions about your pet's health, I hope you'll join in. The number is 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. Amy emailed to say they have an 8-year-old female spayed indoor-outdoor cat diagnosed with feline hyperesthesia. I'm sure I'm not pronouncing that right. Hyperesthesia, I believe.
I bet I can translate. my sense is it's probably hyperesthesia.
There you go. Hyperesthesia syndrome. Amy made an appointment with a neurologist at the vet school, but they wanted to do more than a $3,800 MRI. Is this typically done as diagnostics for FHS? Amy's vet did a physical exam and blood work, but no x-rays or other diagnosis.
Well, in lieu of a $3,800 workup, which is clearly the gold standard, and that's what you pay for, and that's what you expect when you go to the university. Short of that, and it sounds like their veterinarian did a most excellent workup, then we enter the world of what I call therapeutic diagnostics, which is we know that there's a range of things that can cause hypergrooming / hyperesthesia in cats. And it can range from a behavior, in which case it's as a result of the cat being anxious, and sometimes a way of self-soothing is to hypergroom. And they'll lick the fur off their abdomen, lick the fur off their flank. We've seen cats that every hair follicle that they could reach was licked naked. That's on one end of the spectrum. It keeps going up to, and my sense is that if your veterinarian is referring you to the university for a neurologic workup, it can actually be a version of a seizure disorder. And in those cats, possibly if you Google hyperesthesia, I never have, when you look at their fur over their midline, down their back, it almost looks like a wave. Or if you touch them, they will react in a really, really dramatic fashion. And short of the expensive university workup, which is gold standard, there are a number of things that we will try, ranging from steroids to fluoxetine, which is Prozac, to gabapentin, to phenobarbital. And you may want to ask your vet if he would be willing to try something if you don't want to go to the university.
There you go. Thank you so much for that email. Appreciate it very much. Dr. Bill Stork, our guest today, owner and operator of the Lake Mills Veterinary Clinic. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here talking your pet's health with Dr. Bill Stork. Great to have him back with us. And just to mention quickly, tomorrow on the show, it's an environmental day, of course, an outdoor day. Heather Karaka, who's a conservation biologist with the DNR's Wisconsin Bat Program, will talk about bats, and then we'll hear about snakes and other herps in Wisconsin from Joshua Kapfer, a wildlife biologist at UW-Whitewater. That's tomorrow, but right now, your pet's health, and let's go to Annie in Cottage Grove. Annie, hello.
So I have a border collie. He's a border collie mix from the Humane Society, and he's about 13 months old. And I'm just a little concerned about the amount of exercise he needs, because, like, lately I've been taking him to the dog park, and after about an hour, he starts, like, biting at me. So I'm not sure if it's, like, too much exercise, but I normally do, like, probably 3 hours a day of exercise between, like, walking and dog park. And I'm not sure if it's, like, too much or I don't know.
It sounds, Annie, as if First of all, I don't think a border collie can get too much exercise. It also sounds like you're doing a wonderful balance of mental exercise, as in the walks, on the leash around the neighborhood. Lord knows Cottage Grove is growing by the minute. So lots of good neighborhoods so that you can see lots of people and get that kind of stimulation, and then put that together with the dog park and the active, and the activity, the athletic activity. When you talk about a border collie cross that starts biting you, first of all, sounds like a border collie being a border collie, because that's kind of what they were bred to do. But that's the kind of thing that begs some really specific response or lack of response or diversion on your part. And for that, I would recommend the services of a certified behaviorist, a certified positive reward-based behaviorist for those situations. And based on what you've told me, I'm really confident that you wouldn't do, God forbid, shock collars or pinch collars or anything like that. But I would powerfully recommend employing the services of somebody like Dog's Best Friend. We at the Lake Mills Veterinary Clinic have a behaviorist who is awesome and experienced and often booked out, but by telephone or email, she's often able to make some really great suggestions to get you started.
Yeah, that's definitely worth looking into, Annie. And thank you very much for calling.
Yeah, and especially at this age, because you're starting to see the dog's personality unfold, and you've got an excellent opportunity here. You're doing lots of great things. I think this is an opportunity for some expertise.
Good luck, Annie. Thank you very much for calling. Samantha in Whitehall, we'll turn to you next. Hi, Samantha.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. Anyway, I've got a cat. She's 4 years old, and I've had her about 2 years. And she likes to rip papers up. Now, if I even get mail in and I get a bill, I'm not watching her, she'll start ripping it off. Then she likes to nip at me. I mean, you know, I try to play with her, give her food, you know, but there's a time when she just likes to nip at you. She likes to, you know, chew on papers and rip them off. I mean, she's scratching. Been using her scratching post. She'll scratch on the wall and stuff like that. And I've tried different things to do with her, so, you know.
Okay. So we got a cat that loves to chew up paper. Instead of scratching the scratching post, scratches the wall, and sounds like an active cat.
Yeah, sounds like a busy kid. Samantha, does the cat eat the paper that it's ripping up?
Oh, we lost Samantha.
Yeah, we lost Samantha, but you know, it doesn't have to be a bad thing if the cat is simply ripping up the paper, because if that helps dispense with some of that mental and physical energy, then that does not have to be a bad thing. And you said that you've got a scratching post and a cat tree. Those are all really good things. And you mentioned that you try to play with her. I would like to augment that and say that we go from trying to play with that cat to deliberately playing with that cat multiple times per day. I bet you this cat can be engaged. And there are cats like this that can be taught to play fetch. Larry made a really good point. A caller made the really good point about immediately rewarding the cat after it does the things that you ask it to do. Cats can be taught to play fetch. They can chase things. And man, when you play with them multiple installments per day until they're open mouth breathing and panting. Other things that can make a difference is feeding them. And if you're currently feeding the cat from a bowl, that's great. But a thing that can help them work for it a little bit is they make treat balls, food balls, so that you open it up, put the food in there, and then the cat has to bat that ball around to get either treats or food out of it. And we talked earlier about playing hide and seek with your dog. You can play hide and seek with the cat too, and you can take their food and put it in small increments of its food throughout the house, so it has to go looking for it. Bird feeders outside the house is like cable TV for a cat. Can make a really big difference. So, I think you've got a border collie equivalent of a cat.
I was thinking about a sort of a game type thing I saw at the cat and dog store. Looked like a panel with maybe 20 or so sliding little panels. And underneath, if the cat slides one open, there's a treat inside, or it's food. And then it would slide around and move those panels around to get the food. One of the things that I loved about it was there are no batteries required.
Yeah, it's like an advent calendar for cats. And that's a great suggestion as well. That's on the list of puzzle bowls as well.
Lisa and Madison, what's on your mind?
Well, I have two cats, and they're litter mates. And the one cat, I took her to get a lion's mane haircut, and ever since then, they don't get along. And it's been like 5 or 6 years, so that's problem number one. And then problem number two is both cats, they have both their, you know, front and back claws, and they are ripping up my carpeting. They're like tearing up the threads out of the carpeting, so I have scratching posts. I've used feel away, different things like that. I don't know what else to do with the two cats, and they're both 13 years old. So,
and just once again, but by way of consolation, Lisa, we have heard of cats that have existed in the same household for an entire lifetime, and they never get along. And that's a real life consideration. And it sounds like you've done lots of good things with regard to the feel away. Is one or the other of the cats standardly a perpetrator
the spicy orange? Her name is Zoe. She's the spicy one, and they used to be pals. They used to like groom each other and stuff. But once I took Chloe to get her manes cut, that was all over. They haven't been friends since. So
yeah, man. And I wonder if it was a different smell when they came home,
probably the smell,
or what that was all about. It may be time for Prozac. Has that been discussed with your veterinarian?
A couple of years ago, I tried like a liquid form of it, but then trying to get her to open her mouth and like shoot it into her mouth, I'd end up shooting it up against the wall instead of into her mouth. So,
man, I love those discussions. I'm not feeling well. Here, have somebody shove this in your mouth and see if it makes you feel better. But thankfully, the industry that supports us works really, really hard at coming up with versions of medications that are more reasonable to deliver.
Yeah.
There's his finger at me.
I am, and we can talk some more about that. We need to take a quick look at the news and find out what else is in store for us. And we will be back with our guest, Dr. Bill Stork of the Lake Mills Veterinary Clinic. He's with us right up until 12:30 today. I'm Larry Mueller. Taking a look at your pet's health today on the show, Larry Mueller here with my guest, Dr. Bill Storick, owner and operator of the Lake Mills Veterinary Clinic. Great to have him back with us. As we broke for the news, Lisa in Madison was talking about her two cats. One in particular, they didn't like each other very much, and the one cat was probably the instigator more often than not. And you were talking about medications and how they've improved over the years to deal with this kind of thing.
Yeah, I think it's a little bit hopeful to think that they're going to get along again. That's not likely. But what our goal becomes in that situation is for them to coexist in a non-combative fashion and not tear up your house and not destroy your carpet. And I do believe, based on what you've described to me, that it could be time for Prozac. And you'd mentioned that you had tried a liquid form of it before. There are other forms that it comes in. There's a tiny little pill that if the cat eats well, it's a flavored pill that you might be able to hide in some canned food, treats, pill pockets, things like that. And there's also a transdermal version that you can put on their ear, or you can shave an area over their shoulder blades and put it on their skin, and it will be absorbed through their skin. The things to know with regard to fluoxetine Prozac is that it takes a solid 30 days in order to achieve blood levels and to make a difference for them. And all of the other things that you have tried as well, like feel away and things like that, you may try that at the same time, but it could be time for Prozac.
Could be as well. And Helen in Madison has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Helen.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. I've got a four-month-old golden retriever puppy, and this is my first big dog. And I was kind of surprised that you're not supposed to exercise large dogs very much, I guess, until they're about 2 years old. So my question is, I think the rule of thumb was like a 5-minute walk for every month. So that would mean, say, a 20-minute walk for my four-month-old. Does that mean once a day or just at a stretch? Or I guess I don't, of course, want to hurt the puppy's bones, but
sure.
She's very functious. How can I burn off that energy?
Well, here again, it's not my nature to fly in the face of someone else's well-intentioned advice. But when I think of a four-month-old puppy, I think in terms of considerably more exercise. Now, what I could easily get on board with is being a little bit aware of exercise that requires them to change directions and accelerate, decelerate, things like balls and frisbees. That would be where I could meet with regard to limiting exercise. Otherwise, finding other similarly aged dogs to play with, yay. And I feel as if it's 4 months of age, you've kind of got yourself a teenager there, an eighth grader, so to speak, and socializing them and having them play with other dogs is unbelievably valuable. I would not think in terms of putting a limit on how far and how frequently I walk them. Within common sense, I mean, if the dog is dragging and wants to lay down and their tongue is hanging out, it's time to take a break. But I would exercise that dog in order to burn off their mental and physical energy. And an editorial in there would be not necessarily having to do with that piece of advice. Independent of that piece of advice, lots of those dogs will have ACL, knee issues, anterior cruciate ligament issues. Those surgeries are highly effective at putting those dogs back to athleticism after a three-month recovery. They're also really expensive. Some people will either, one, save the money, or two, buy insurance for them. But in my opinion, exercising that puppy is not going to make those issues any more likely.
Helen, there you go. Thank you very much for calling. John and Baronette, your turn.
Hi, guys.
Hi, what's on your mind?
I've got two dogs. I've got an 8-year-old 100% German Shepherd and about a 14-year-old lab mix that I inherited. But anyway, they both have started scratching a lot. As if they had fleas, but I don't believe they have fleas. I can't find any fleas on them. I dug around in their coats and all that kind of stuff. And I front line them once a month. Wondering if you have any ideas what else could make them itch and scratch.
John, do you live out in the country by any chance?
Yes, sir.
Okay. We see itchy dogs starting somewhere mid-September until the snow flies. And if it weren't for itchy dogs in September and October, I'd probably have to do something dramatic like golf or something like that. We spend so much time on itchy dogs. And with regard to fleas, hopefully your front line is helping you out. And I am slow to disparage front line because when it came onto the market 20 some odd years ago, it was a game changer. But it's been on the market for 20 some odd years. So we can't completely dismiss the possibility of fleas just because we're on front line and because you can't find them. Because we seldom see adult fleas, even when there are fleas. What we see is flea dirt, which is a polite way of saying flea poop. And what we look for is we take literally the fine tooth comb, comb through them. And if we see little black coffee ground looking dots, we wet those dots up. And if they streak a little red, that is suggestive that there may be fleas at work. And the notion that it's happened to two slightly older dogs at the same time is suggestive. The reason why I asked you if you lived out in the country, also on the list of possibilities for two dogs that start itching at the same time, is there are some sneaky little mites out there. Sarcoptic mites and things like that. And if perchance they're anything like my dogs, they could run across a raccoon or especially a fox or a coyote carcass. Those guys are crawling with mites. And those things are microscopic. And I would be worried about that. And it may take a veterinarian to do a skin scraping, look at them under the microscope to ensure that we're not dealing with parasites.
All right, John, there you go. Thank you very much for calling. Need to see the vet. Debbie in Black Earth, hi, what's on your mind?
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have a cat who's approximately 14 years old. She's been on prednisone for about 5-6 years. We're trying to kind of step her off that by reducing it in a very slow way. She's on a prescription dry food, but of course, you know, like all cat owners, I like to spoil my cat and give her special things. So I'm wondering, is there any, like, people food? I've tried steamed carrots. She won't eat that. I've tried, pumpkin. She won't eat that. To kind of settle her stomach. She has raging diarrhea all the time.
Okay, Deb. So you answered the question that I didn't have to ask, which is why is she on prednisone? And the answer is because she has raging diarrhea. And May I ask why it is that you're trying to wean her off the Pred?
The vet suggested, because she has been on it for so long, that, you know, it's not good to take long term.
Yeah, and that's a very, very noble notion. And we would prefer to have them either, obviously we'd prefer for them not to be on prednisone, but if they're going to be on prednisone, we would prefer for them to be on less prednisone. But if a reasonable dose of prednisone, for example, a couple of milligrams once a day, a couple of milligrams every other day, is keeping weight on your cat, at least slowing down the diarrhea, and if the cat is still eating when it's on a slightly higher dose of prednisone, what that's suggestive of is this condition that's broadly, it's more of a category, called inflammatory bowel disease. And there are lots of ways that can manifest. There are lots of root causes of that. And if they do better on more prednisone, within reason, sometimes we stick with it. And as far as things that they can eat, everything you mentioned were vegetables. And if I'm searching to get my cat that's a little bit anorectic to eat something, you know, baby food is the classic recommendation. Chicken, tuna, things like that.
Debbie, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. And let's turn to Perry in Oconto next.
Yes, I have a question, but I also have just a comment on the lady with the golden lab. One of the two biggest things about that joint problems is, one, jumping. I had a problem with that, too. It's hard to keep them from jumping up or jumping down. Jumping is probably the worst when they jump down. The second thing is, when you spay or neuter, if that's in the plans, waiting till they're maybe at least 18 months old or 2 years is also a good idea for the ACL joint. My question, though, is on learning first aid for dogs. If you're hiking or hunting, you're going to be maybe miles from the car. Where can you kind of bone up on some of the techniques or what you need to know, Dr. Bill?
You know, Perry, that's a really great idea. And if you're in the Lake Mills area, the answer to that question is you come to the Pharmacy Public House on downtown Lake Mills when we're doing our what we call a pet partners series, and we do little lectures about how to prepare for stuff like that, and, you know, basic bandages, and you know, like you say, a lot of people like to get as far off the grid as they possibly can. Man, I don't know a point source of reliable information that's out there on the great big interweb with regard to basic bandages. You know, some of the things that you always want to include on your person, as simple as it may seem, is Benadryl. Because one of the really common things that can happen out there is they can get stung or they can get bitten and they can swell. And Benadryl can be really, really valuable to have, you know, if they should get lacerated on a stick or a rock or something like that. Having some vet wrap and some cotton padding can come in really, really handy as well. Eye drops can be very, very convenient. Boy, even if you have a dog that's prone to putting everything in their mouth, a bit of peroxide in the event that they should eat something that doesn't belong, can be handy as well. That's a perfect question. And what I can do is I can look for a source, feed it back to the good folks at Wisconsin Public Radio, and I bet you they'd be willing to post it for us.
And Dr. Bill, do you post, you know, when you're going to do one of those sessions, do you post that up on Lake Mills Veterinary Clinic website?
On our Facegram, on our Instabook, yes. We post it on our social media feeds.
All right. So that's another thing you might want to check, Perry, or anybody else for that matter, when those sessions are going. There you go. Kelly in Amherst Junction, what's on your mind?
Yes, I have a four-year-old Corgi Blue Heeler mix, and this dog has been a challenge from day one. The two biggest problems are the chronic barking at any sound whatsoever, and it's a shrill, loud bark, very disconcerting. He also, I've taken him to the vet twice for this, the way he chews and licks at his paw. There's nothing in there. There was no, you know, stone or glass or anything. So he went through two rounds of the medication that was supposed to stop a certain mold they think this dog had from being in contact with squirrels that he chases and other animals. After two rounds of medication, I didn't get a third. The behavior's there, and I guess I Googled this particular dog mix, and they said these dogs tend to have a problem with boredom, and that is maybe why he does that with his paws. I guess my question is he too old to start with some kind of a, you know, barking collar to just stop the chronic kind of barking? And he is isolated. We live in a farm. He does not see any other dogs. He doesn't see other dogs. So I guess if you know anything about corgis, does this sound at all familiar?
Sounds like lightning in a bottle. A corgi heeler cross, hybrid bigger of two extremely engaged working dogs. And what it is that you've described, aside from the paw, is not a surprise. And while you live out on a farm, that's wonderful because that gives them an opportunity to get a whole big bunch of physical exercise. But for our clients, when they live out in the country, we suggest that in order to keep them socialized and stimulated, we also make a deliberate effort to take them to town where they get to see lots of other people and hear lots of other sounds. You know, I don't know where the nearest town to Amherst Junction is, but I also predict that would be a bit of a challenge, because if that dog barks at everything while in your house, he's also going to bark at everything when you go to town and take the dog for a walk on a leash. The things that you have described with regard to the behavior are going to take a long time of really deliberate responses, because if you're human in the least bit, when the dog starts barking at oxygen, then you start barking at them. And, you know, be quiet, shut up, try to put a leash on them, whatever the case may be, which will only serve to magnify the situation. So the basic approach to situations like this is what we call counter conditioning. And you have to recognize whatever it is that Lightning is about to start barking at. Get them to do what you want them to do before they do what they're about to do, and reward them for it. And then all you have to really do is repeat that behavior about 12,000 times consistently in order to start to redirect that behavior. Please no bark collars, because when you say bark collars, that suggests that they're going to get an unpleasant stimulus in response to the barking. In which case, they associate that unpleasant stimulus to whatever it is that they're barking at, whether that be the milk truck driver or the Amazon delivery person or whomever. And that we wish to not do. If the paw licking is about boredom, and you mentioned paw as in singular, there's just one foot that he's licking at, right?
Yeah.
Correct.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, it very well could be boredom. So this is going to be a multifactorial issue. So going to be a challenge, but not an insurmountable challenge. And at this point in time, I think Larry is soon going to be giving me the finger, as in the finger to say we're getting close to time.
And I would just say a certified applied animal behaviorist could be really helpful in showing you how to do those things that Dr. Bill was talking about.
And Kelly, Bill Stork doesn't speak in a great deal of absolutes, but please don't let anyone put a shock collar on that dog.
There
it
you
will
go.
Make things exponentially worse.
Gregory emailed, is there something done you can do to prevent lipomas developing on either of their two labs? Is there a dog food or supplements or diet you recommend?
Barnacles and all. The short answer is no. It seems like an obligatory obligatory occurrence as these guys age.
Yeah, and they're... And typically not a problem, but they need to be kind of dealt with.
Perfect point. And we never take them lightly, because we've seen dogs that have had 15 lipomas, and the 16th lump that felt very similar was something considerably more threatening.
Yeah. Well, I tell you what, Dr. Bill, it's always such a pleasure to have you with us. I really appreciate your time. It's a lot of time. And I hope we'll do it again.
We do the best we can. Have a wonderful day.
Bill, thank you so much. Dr. Bill Stork, owner and operator of the Lake Mills Veterinary Clinic. Great to have him with us today. And great to have you listening in, and stay listening, because up next we have a conversation we had with the Appleton veterinarian, Dr. Laura Russo-Clister, about caring for rabbits and hamsters and guinea pigs. That next. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thanks so much for staying with us here on Wisconsin Public Radio News. Larry Mueller here. We're going to turn our attention to small animals, hamsters, rabbits, and guinea pigs. They can be great pets because, I don't know, they're quiet. They don't take up a lot of space. But you know what? They still require loving and attentive care. And we're going to be talking about that, some of those smaller animals you might have as pets, with our guest, Dr. Laura Russo-Clister, with us. She's a veterinarian at North Heights Veterinary Clinic in Appleton. She's been there, I think, about 12 years or thereabouts, and has a greyhound named Lupe, and she also has a calico cat named Princess Buttercup. But she takes care of many of these small animals. And I hope you'll join in with your questions or comments. You have a guinea pig? How do you care for that? Or a hamster? Wondering what kind of food you should be feeding your tiny friend? Give us a call. The number is 800 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's WPR, talk@WPR.org. Dr. Laura Russo-Klister, welcome. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So we're going to focus on hamsters and rabbits and guinea pigs today. Before somebody adopts one of these small animals, what should they be considering?
Well, I think it's the same kind of things you need to think about before you bring any pet into your home. You need to think about, do I have the space? Do I have the time? Do the other inhabitants of my house, are they compatible with the type of animal? So do I have a big dog who really likes to chase tiny things? You know, if that's the case and we still want that little pet, do we have a way to keep that pet safe? Do I have small children? Can I keep my new little pet safe from the small children? And then also just generally, you know, we have to think about, how do we care for these creatures? Because I think a lot of people think, oh, they're small, they don't take up a lot of space, they don't need much. And we don't always think about what exactly they need to be as happy as possible.
And, you know, when I think about care, here you are at North Heights Veterinary Clinic, and you have the ability to treat these small mammals. And I'm wondering, how common are clinics like yours? Would any vet be able to help with an animal like perhaps a hamster?
You know, it depends on the comfort of the individual veterinarian. So, for instance, we have 6 veterinarians here, and 2 of us will see small mammal patients. I know there are definitely a lot of clinics out there that really only want to focus on dogs and cats. So it's not a bad idea before you want to have a pet like that to see if you have a vet in your area who will take care of a small animal pet.
Yeah, that's for sure. Let's take them one by one, maybe a little bit. Rabbits. Let's start with rabbits, mostly because I had rabbits when I was a young guy. Describe the routine veterinary care for a rabbit's needs.
Yeah. So at least in our practice, any pet, we do recommend a yearly wellness exam, the same as you would for a dog or a cat. So that includes, you know, we do a full, what we call a husbandry review. So husbandry is all of the things that go into care and keeping of an animal. So we go through their diet, their housing, their bedding, their, you know, just everything that we're doing. So to take care of them at home, we do a physical examination. So our small animal pets don't necessarily need all of the same kind of parasite screening all of the time that you do for, say, a dog or a cat, where we'll do heartworm testing or we'll do stool samples for parasites. We don't necessarily always need to do that with a rabbit, but there is now a vaccination for rabbits that's becoming an important thing to do. I don't know if you've heard of this before, but so there's an emerging disease that has been present in Europe and Asia for at least 10 years that started in wild rabbits. It has been seen now in the United States, and it's making its way from the West inward.
Mm.
So it's rabbit hemorrhagic disease virus. It is so spread by wild rabbits, but if any pet rabbit were to go outside or to be given grass that had been contaminated or anything like that, they can get this disease. And the first sign of the disease is usually sudden death. So it's really important now that we have a vaccine for that disease to have your rabbit vaccinated for that. Currently, it's every 6 months to get boosted. I think in the future, it'll probably be down to once a year.
Well, man, that's something, to really be concerned about. And there's a good vaccine for it. So there mm-hmm. we go. That's the good news there. You know, one of the fun facts that I learned when I had rabbits was their teeth are constantly growing.
Yeah.
And there are some, you want to make sure those rabbit's teeth are at a healthy length.
Yeah. So that's true actually of our guinea pigs as well. Their teeth continuously grow, and that's because they eat really rough food that grinds down their teeth, which means we need to make sure that they're eating the right kind of rough foods that grind down their teeth appropriately, which means that the bulk of their diet needs to be hay. There's the pelleted foods that you can feed to rabbits and guinea pigs. And in moderate or small, you know, appropriate amounts, they're good for them as far as vitamins, minerals, et cetera. But the thing that's really going to keep their teeth healthy and in a good alignment is going to be eating free choice hay. So access to hay at all times, because they just need to be chewing most of the day.
Yeah, I grew up on a farm, so that was never a problem for us.
Yeah, so now people, like, so as far as food products in general for all of our small rodents, Oxbow is a brand that does an excellent job. They sell hay, they sell the pellets, they have vitamin tablets for guinea pigs. If people are looking for a recommendation, usually we'll say if you're looking for hay, you're looking for pellets, get the Oxbow brand.
What about, you know, I don't think I ever gave a rabbit a bath, to be perfectly honest. But I imagine these days, maybe you need to give a rabbit a bath once in a while. Mine seem to be really good at cleaning themselves.
Yeah, well, I think they're a little bit more along the lines of a cat, where you don't do it unless you really, really have to do it.
Yeah, and then I would imagine it's almost like trying to give your cat a bath.
Well, yeah, we do have that be where maybe a rabbit needs to get cleaned up. What can happen sometimes is if their litter box doesn't stay clean enough, or if they are a long-haired breed, they can get pretty caked back around there with like fecal matter back around their private areas. We can have them brought in to the vet, and we will deal with kind of clipping and cleaning that, because no, rabbits don't like that.
One of the things I think I was always pretty good at was making sure there was water available, and they do need water.
Absolutely. Yep. At all times.
And I would let mine out of the cage.
Regardless of how big of an area you have for them, it is really important for them to get out and hop around for a couple hours, at least a few times a week, if not daily. It's for people. So house rabbits are getting to be a pretty big trend as far as keeping rabbits, where they're either free roaming all the time, or they have run of a room or a part of a house for a good chunk of the day. And that's really good for them, for their intestinal tract especially. So their digestion kind of depends on eating hay, mm-hmm. having healthy teeth, and then getting out and getting that exercise.
Yeah. How social would you describe them? I never had less than two. I never had just a single rabbit, but how social do you think they are, and should they be bought in pairs?
Yeah, so rabbits are actually a social animal. They do enjoy each other's company, and keeping them in groups of two or three is probably their ideal setup. If you are only going to have one rabbit, you're going to have to expect to be even more having more social time with them, because then you are their social outlet.
Our guest today, Dr. Laura Rosso-Clister, a veterinarian at North Heights Veterinary Clinic in Appleton, and we're zeroing in on what George Villara likes to call the pocket pets, in a way, the rabbits, the hamsters, and the guinea pigs. Do you have one of those, or would you like to have one of those? Maybe you have some and you're wondering about health or care needs. Give us a call. The number is 800 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or shoot us an email, email address talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today on WPR News. We're talking about caring for rabbits and hamsters and guinea pigs. And if you have a question, I hope you'll join in. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Or you could email us, the email address, talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. I was going to turn to guinea pigs, and here's Barb in Westcott with a question I think that relates to guinea pigs. So let's go there. Hi, Barb. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Okay, so I've got a guinea pig we've had for almost a year. It was my grandson's, and when he moved into an apartment, he would have had to pay like $125 extra a month for a guinea pig. So he said, Grandma, can you please take him, Carl? And I said, yes, I will. So I'm now the proud owner of Carl. I love him to death. He still will not let me pick him up. And it'll be a year in August, so it's not quite a year. But, yeah, he's quite bashful. I can pet him. He zooms around. He's free range in the bedroom, and he does his business in his cage so he can jump in and out of the cage. Bathing. I need to know about bathing, too. Does he need to be bathed?
All right. How does Barb get Carl to allow her to pick him up?
Yeah,
and what about bathing?
Pigs. Yeah. Sure. Well, the bathing is, I think, the easier question. So guinea pigs will, you can bathe a guinea pig. You would do a really shallow, like an inch or two of water that they can just walk around in, nice and warm for them. You can soap them up with some baby shampoo. And the important thing is after you rinse them, that you keep them nice and warm until they're all the way dry, because they can get cold easily. So usually keep them wrapped up in a towel, or you can blow dry them. You don't have to bathe them, but especially if they're getting kind of dusty or crusty, then you can go ahead and do that. If you need to brush them, a toothbrush works really well. So, but it's not a requirement. As far as taming a guinea pig, for one thing, you don't have to be super worried about them biting you. Usually they're just going to make a lot of noise and squiggle around. So a lot of times if he trusts you enough to let you get your hands on him, you might be able to just kind of pick him up and then get him cradled into a nice, really supported position. And if you do that every day for a while, he'll start to get the idea, oh, this getting picked up thing isn't that bad.
Yeah.
So that's probably where I would start.
Do they like, are there treats that guinea pigs like, Dr. Laura?
Yeah, so this is actually kind of an important question for both guinea pigs and rabbits. So their nutritional needs in some ways are pretty similar. So we want to avoid with them anything sugary or starchy as much as we can. So I know at the pet store you can get these different like yogurt chips and different kinds of treats that way. I would tend more towards if there's a type of green or a vegetable that they like a lot, or if we're not overdoing it, you can do a little bit of apple, you can do a little bit of like a strawberry or something like that. So more of like a natural fruit or vegetable treat. We also though have to be really careful about how much treats we're giving our rabbits and our guinea pigs. Even like say a carrot a day, that's going to be way too much for them, and it can cause diarrhea and it can cause stomach problems. So we want to lean more towards the greens and the veggies.
I was thinking that maybe if Barb got Carl up on her lap and she had a strawberry or something that she could save the treats for when Carl's on the lap.
Yeah, exactly. The same as you would with a dog or a cat.
Yeah. Although I got to tell you, Barb, I've got a cat named Tiger that is 12 years old, and Tiger likes to sit right next to me all the time, but as soon as I try to put Tiger on my lap, Tiger runs, will not do it. So I think there's some personality involved with Tiger, and I'm wondering, with that cat, the other one loves to sit on my lap. And maybe that's true with guinea pigs, too?
Oh, yeah, they definitely have personalities.
you might have some trouble with that, Bar. Does all this help, by the way?
It does. It is helping. I was going to say, when I do finally get to pick Carl up and put him on my lap, he'll snuggle with me. It's just the idea of, he loves to snuggle. He'll climb into my shirt and up on my shoulder, and he's as happy as can be. But just
so some of that is guinea pigs too. They're not always going to just come up to you and ask to be held. Some of it is, I think, just their dignity as a guinea pig. They have to run away. But if you catch them, then okay, this is fine.
It's really interesting. Barb, thanks a lot for calling, and I'm glad you got. I think Carl got lucky there when he got you for a second owner. How long do guinea pigs typically live, Dr. Laura?
Yeah, they can live between 4 and 8 years. I've definitely seen guinea pigs older than that. But around, if you want to budget, 5, 6, 7 years is probably average.
What are the signs that your guinea pig might be unwell or needs to be taken to the vet? I mean, you're probably, I'm sure the once a year is probably a good thing, but what if in between times?
Yeah, so this is true for both guinea pigs and rabbits. The most crucial thing is if they are not eating and they're not defecating, that is a sick guinea pig, that's a sick rabbit. They need to be seen as soon as possible. So guinea pigs and rabbits, the way their GI tract works, they need to be eating pretty constantly in order for it to stay healthy and keep moving. They can enter something called GI stasis, where their digestion processes just stop. That can be triggered by all sorts of things, by eating too many treats, all the way to having some other type of life-threatening illness, like a GI obstruction or a liver lobe torsion. It can be along that whole range of things, but if they stop eating, that can actually kill them before whatever else is wrong with them does. So if they are not eating their hay, or if you're noticing that they're not producing poop, they need to go in.
And what do you do when they come to see?
So as far as, and that's kind of like the most common and serious problem we'll see with rabbits and guinea pigs. So it's two things. One is we are trying to figure out what triggered it, what's going on with them. But then the other thing is we need to support them nutritionally and usually pain-wise, because GI stasis is painful and the pain will also keep them from wanting to eat and perpetuate the problem. So we call it assist feeding. It's kind of like force feeding is the mainstay of treatment. So if they're not going to take in food on their own, we're going to keep supplying it. And this is something we recommend that all owners of rabbits or guinea pigs potentially just have on hand in case they can't get into the vet right away. There are these Oxbow makes a critical care herbivore, or there's Emerade critical care. And it's a powdered food that you mix with water and then you syringe feed it into their mouth. They don't really like it. You usually have to wrap them in a towel and make a little burrito out of them so that you can force feed them. You feed them about every 4 hours until they start to want to eat on their own. So that's the support. And then we also, we might have x-rays, we might have blood work, things that we need to do to figure out why this is going on. I'm looking at their teeth, because it can also be a teeth, like sometimes it's a tooth issue.
Stephanie emailed us, their 9-year-old rabbit's spine is calcifying, so the vet gave them gabapentin and meloxicam for the pain. Unfortunately, they've been unsuccessful in giving her these meds, which are in liquid form. They tried the bunny burrito, and she's totally uncooperative, and they're afraid of how angry and upset she gets. For a couple of weeks, she was taking them mixed in with banana or mango or apple. Now she refuses those too. They don't want her living in pain. They believe in quality of life is more important than quantity of life. Would you euthanize if they just can't get their pain or medication?
You know, I think this is a question, you know, a lot of the things in veterinary medicine, it doesn't matter what the species, we kind of run into these conversations, right? So I think that usually comes down to an individual conversation with your veterinarian about it, because is there maybe a better technique that we could be doing to try to get the medication in? Sometimes we'll do training sessions with owners. We'll have a technician go in there with the owner and make sure that they know how to get the how to do the burrito properly, how to put the medication in. So sometimes it's a technique thing, but I think anytime you're talking about an animal that's in pain that we can't help, then sometimes we do have to make that sad but necessary decision.
Yeah. So, and a lot of times it's the owner that knows when it's probably the best time. Yeah.
Well, right. Yeah.
Hamsters, we haven't mentioned them yet. They probably need a yearly checkup as well, I'm guessing.
Yeah. So hamsters, they only live between 1.5 and 3 years.
Oh,
so
okay.
They have a much shorter lifespan. Generally, we do. What I think it's a good idea if you're getting anytime you get a new pet to get them checked out, just to screen for any issues, especially like any our hamsters, our guinea pigs, our rabbits. They can carry ringworm. They can carry fleas, things that you might not want to bring into your house. So at a minimum, you want them checked out when you purchase them. There's actually multiple types of hamsters. There's different species, but they can be divided into the Syrian or golden hamster, which is kind of a bigger hamster, and they can live for 3 years. All of the dwarf species, they're smaller ones, they only live about 1.5 years or so. So at a minimum, you do want to get them checked out when you get them. And then if you've got a Syrian hamster, a yearly exam's not a bad idea.
And they're nocturnal, aren't they?
They are.
So what about playing with them?
Well, right, that's the thing. So you can rouse them as long as you're kind of gentle about it. Don't just kind of startle them awake because then you might get bit. But yeah, the better time to be playing with them would be like later in the evening. Because yeah, they're not going to feel too playful being woken up in the middle of the day. It's kind of like me coming into your bedroom at midnight and being like, hey, let's go play now, you know?
And their claws, I mean, they're small. Do you need to cut their claws?
You can need to cut them. You'd have to look at them. So that's true. Guinea pigs and rabbits also definitely need their nails trimmed. Hamsters can need their nails trimmed. So the most important thing in order for being able to know that is hamsters are a little harder to make, to like maintain tameness. If you ignore them for a while, they're going to kind of forget that they were tame. So if you're going to have a hamster, it's kind of important to have a regular schedule of daily taking them out and playing with them, preferably later in the day, since then they're more likely to want to be awake.
Well, I tell you what, this has been most interesting, but the time flew. I hope we can have you back and talk again when we have more time. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
It's been a lot of fun. Dr. Laura Russo-Clister is a veterinarian at North Heights Veterinary Clinic in Appleton. It was really fun talking with her, and we'll maybe get her back and do this again. Thank you for listening today. Stay with us. Lots in store. I'm Larry Mueller.